Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The firm, formerly known as Blackwater, now Z, has been a controversial, shadowy constant of America's post-9/11 years. After a shooting spree left 17 dead in a public square in Baghdad, cries came to rein in armed contractors. But the Blackwater phenomenon has not gone away easily. In fact, it seems it hasn't gone away at all. New reports suggest the private army moving even deeper into American military and intelligence arenas. This hour, On Point, the stubborn resilience of Blackwater. You can join the conversation, why are armed private contractors still very much with us, and what does it mean? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's hear the voice of Blackwater. Congressional testimony, October 2007. Here's Blackwater CEO and founder Eric Prince defending the reputation of his company.
Blackwater is a team of dedicated professionals who provide training to America's military and law enforcement communities and risk their lives to protect Americans in harm's way overseas. Under the direction and oversight of the United States government, Blackwater provides an opportunity for military and law enforcement veterans with a record of honorable service to continue their support to the United States.
Joining me now from New York is Jeremy Scahill, investigative journalist and author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. He writes for The Nation magazine. He's won two George Polk Awards, including one for his work on Blackwater. Jeremy, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me back.
We're looking to catch up with Blackwater with Z today. Give us a sense, where is Blackwater in its evolution now?
Well, I mean, Blackwater is sort of, there's sort of two major stories here. One is the heat that Blackwater is facing right now from Congress, from the Justice Department, from the IRS and other U.S. government agencies for its activities in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. Last week, two Blackwater contractors were arrested by the FBI on murder charges that stem from a shooting that happened in Afghanistan in May of 2009, where they were alleged to have opened fire unprovoked on a civilian vehicle, killing two Afghans. Blackwater, though, won some substantial victories in its legal troubles. Recently, a federal judge threw out the most high-profile criminal case against the company, and that stems from the Nisr Square shooting that you mentioned, where those 17 Iraqis were killed. Judge Ricardo Urbina threw out the charges against the men, not because they were not guilty, but on a technicality, saying that the prosecutors had engaged in misconduct and had used statements that the men gave with promise of immunity to bring the case against them. And so that case is thrown out. The Justice Department is weighing whether or not to appeal it. On the other front, though, Blackwater's business, in a way, has never been better. Under the Obama administration, Blackwater continues to work in Afghanistan for the Department of Defense, where it trains Afghan forces, for the State Department, where it continues to guard Ambassador Eikenberry, congressional delegations, all of the top diplomats there. And as we know from the Khost bombing by Mr. al-Balawi, in Afghanistan on December 30th, Blackwater continues to work for the CIA as well, including in very sensitive operations. So despite all of the troubles, Tom, and the scandals, Blackwater seems to be doing a pretty robust business under the Obama administration.
Here's a company founded by Eric Prince, who was the son, scion of an auto parts fortune out of Michigan, former Navy SEAL. His father died. That company was sold in the mid-90s for $1.5 billion. He bought a lot of land in North Carolina, seemed almost presciently to position himself for what came after 9/11, and then suddenly used all over the place in the war on terror $1.5 billion from the U.S. government to Blackwater between 2001 and 2009. What about the scale of Blackwater's operations and contracting with the U.S. government today? Up, down, steady?
Steady. And I would say in some sectors of Blackwater's business, it's going up. Blackwater right now is the top candidate for a $1 billion contract in Afghanistan that is a training contract. And one of their main competitors, DynCorp, has been eliminated from the bidding because of some technicalities. DynCorp is protesting that, but Blackwater really is the front runner there. I should say, Tom, also that of that $1.5 billion, that's just for the diplomatic security contracts with the U.S. State Department. Mm. We don't actually know the full extent of Blackwater's business with the federal government. But Eric Prince, on the day he testified in front of Congress, and you played that clip of him, he said that Blackwater takes in 90% of its revenue, 90% of its revenue from the federal government. And I think that the real story here that is only starting to come out is how deeply embedded in sensitive U.S. intelligence operations Blackwater has been, really from the launch of the so-called war on terror. That's what got them into the mercenary game. And that's really where I think the scandal is in the Congress right now in the Intelligence Committee. What was Blackwater's role in a CIA assassination program?
You've been reporting very closely on this for years. In just the last month in Vanity Fair, we saw Eric Prince come out and talk quite openly about his role on the intelligence front, describing himself as not just a CEO, but actually a sort of a spy master asset, as the CIA would put it, himself.
Right. I mean, this is an incredible story. And I, when the Vanity Fair story came out, I was starting to hear rumblings from within Blackwater that Eric Prince was going to sort of strike back at the media and strike back at the government investigations. And what Eric Prince was doing by speaking to Vanity Fair was a well-known legal tactic known as graymailing. And I'll just break that down. When a covert operative or a someone who has been an asset for the CIA or the NSA or other U.S. intelligence agencies feels like they're going to become the sort of fall guy for some operations that went south or a scandal, what they'll do is they'll leak a bit of the information about some of the things that they were involved with as a way of warning the government essentially to back off of them because there's a lot more that they can tell. What is emerging as the most explosive thing that Eric Prince said in that Vanity Fair article has to do with a secret team that he claims to have trained of CIA operatives that were going to be an elite assassination squad. And he trained them post 9/11, not at the farm, the agency's training facility, but at his own home in Virginia. And then, Tom, Eric Prince is alleged to have led a team of men into Hamburg, Germany, post 9/11, where they went in dark, meaning that the German government didn't know they were there, nor did the CIA station chief. And the allegation or the bragging here is that they were there to bump off or kill a Syrian-born, naturalized German citizen, and their mission was find, fix, and finish. You find the target, you fix their location and their routine, and then you finish them off. At the last moment, we understand it was called off by the CIA. The German government is now probing this and looking into it, saying, what on earth was Blackwater doing coming into our country to potentially bump off one of our citizens? Imagine if we hired a private company to insert in New Orleans, for instance, to go after a U.S. citizen. So this is a scandal that's building not just in the U.S., but also in one of the U.S.'s closest allies in Germany.
You say, Jeremy Scahill, that Blackwater, now Z, has been very nimble in its evolution through these years, and it's evolving again. Its operational focus is now shifting onto new frontiers. Describe those for us.
Well, I mean, I think if there's one quality that's really defined Eric Prince and Blackwater, it's that they're the sort of Teflon dons of the war industry. You know, not many other companies would be able to endure the kind of scandals that that Blackwater has. And what's happened is that Eric Prince remains the sole owner of the Blackwater empire, and there's about 20 affiliates. They have their own Air Force, a maritime division. They have a private intelligence company called Total Intelligence Solutions, which is hired by Fortune 500 corporations, by the U.S. government and by foreign governments to essentially run a private CIA, and it's flush with former CIA executives. And Blackwater is shifting a lot of its business now into the world of privatized intelligence. And rather than relying solely or very heavily on the U.S. government, Blackwater is really marketing what it calls CIA-type services to Fortune 500 corporations. So that's a big part of what we're going to see over the coming years if Blackwater remains in business, is really becoming a major player for transnational corporations that are operating in countries where the local population may not want them there, or it's considered a volatile environment for U.S. businesses or personnel.
And when the alleged double agent blew up his suicide belt in Khost, the CIA base in Eastern Afghanistan, among those killed, as I guess we understand, two Blackwater agents doing what?
Right. Well, there are conflicting reports about this. The initial reporting on it was that the two Blackwater men who were killed in that bombing were not doing security, but were engaged in some other kind of activity. NBC News reported on this. Other media outlets reported it as well.
And this was a reported drone launching base or targeting base.
This was – you're correct, but it was more than that. My understanding from intelligence sources that I've talked with is that the Coast Station at Forward Operating Base Chapman was one of the primary areas where they managed the drone bombing program in neighboring Pakistan. But also this was the epicenter of the CIA's hunt for Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two man in al-Qaeda. And the way that Mr. al-Balawi managed to make it onto that forward operating base was that he claimed to have just met with Ayman al-Zawahiri. And so what I understand is that he came not to the front gates of Chapman, but was brought to a sort of back entrance. He cleared the first two layers of security. And I hear from people that the Blackwater men were actually there to guard the number two person in the CIA, this contract that goes back to 2002. Mm-hmm. The guy walks into the courtyard. Contrary to some of the reporting, I understand that he did not blow himself up in the middle of a building or when the meeting had started. He had come into the courtyard. The Blackwater guys went over to frisk him. One of the Blackwater men, who is a former Army Special Forces soldier, went up to frisk him. As he was approaching him, the man had his hand in his pocket. The Blackwater guy told him to get his hand out of his pocket. He didn't do that. The Blackwater guy ran at him, and then he detonated the bomb. And some people say that that Blackwater individual actually saved lives because of his swift response to it. Other people, however, say, look, if Blackwater's job was to guard one of the top CIA officials in Afghanistan, how does a suicide bomber get within a mile of this individual, not to mention 50 feet or so?
Jeremy Scahill, we're coming up to a break here. In a word, are we headed out of the private contracting armed era or headed in deeper?
Obama is going to surpass Bush-era levels in a matter of weeks, really. We're going to have a huge privatization of war in Afghanistan that's going to accelerate.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Blackwater and private contracting, still in the headlines, still very much in the game. Here's a little more of Blackwater CEO and founder Eric Prince talking a couple of years ago with Charlie Rose. Prince musing here about whether his company might usefully intervene in other hot spots around the world. You can hear his peculiar mix of idealism and business at work.
You watch the movie Hotel Rwanda or Sometimes in April or one of those and say, man, someone's got to do something. And, if someone asked us to do that, to say, hey, go send 500 or 600 folks to create some savings, secure the airport, take that radio station off the air so that it's not inciting the hoodoos to keep killing the Tutsis. Yes, private sector could have done that. And we would welcome the oversight. Send 50 U.S. military advisors or U.N. military officers from some country.
Blackwater's Eric Prince, anything possible for a price? You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. What do you see going on, unfolding here? Jeremy Scahill is with us from New York, writes for The Nation magazine, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and it's great to have him back with us today. We're joined as well now from Middlebury, Vermont, by Kateri Carmola. She's professor of political science at Middlebury College, author of the forthcoming book, Private Security Contractors and New Wars, Risk, Law, and Ethics. It's out next month. Kateri Carmola, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
How do you see the arc of what's going on with Blackwater, or Z, and private contracting by the U.S. military and now U.S. intelligence? Up, down, steady. How do you see it?
I think Jeremy's right. I think it's going to be a steady direction, and I think that's for a very complex set of reasons. I think these guys really are embedded in our command structure and embedded in our model of how we go to war, and I think it's going to be very hard to disentangle that complex embeddedness.
But embedded in our command structure, since when and why? I mean, we went to many wars without mercenaries at our side, private contractors.
Yeah, I think the important thing to keep in mind is the individual actors that are hired by Blackwater are former military and a lot of these top-level companies or former CIA. And so they're part of the same organizations that they're now working for. They're former members of those. And so even if Eric Prince, well, with himself with a military background and CIA aspirations, which is the interesting thing the Vanity Fair article mm-hmm. brings out, is that he's living out his fantasy of being a kind of tycoon who gets to be hired by the government, or especially his favorite organization, the CIA. They're embedded – the personalities are embedded with these networks of other individuals that they've worked for. And so it's very hard to grow from below a larger CIA or grow from below a larger special operations forces. And so they really need to work together with these guys. We don't have enough – literally, we don't have enough well-trained boots on the ground.
Jeremy Scahill, James Risen and Mark Mazzetti have been doing a lot of reporting in the New York Times. They quote a former top CIA officer calling this a very brotherly relationship. You quote a military source calling it a circle of love. I mean, okay, they comrades in arms maybe at one time. They know each other well. But what has changed structurally in U.S. Military and intelligence operations that this is somehow seen as required now, this adjunct private armed force?
Well, I think that it's important to note that in the early stages of the aftermath of 9/11, you saw the White House really going into the Central Intelligence Agency, Cheney going there, 20-something times on his own in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, and also meeting one-on-one with General McChrystal, who from 2003 to 2008 was the head of the Joint Special Operations Command, the most elite special forces of the U.S. military, mm-hmm. And the only entity within the military that is exempt from posse comitatus, the ban on the military operating on U.S. soil. And what we saw is Blackwater and a handful of other companies offering both the special forces community and the CIA a really plausible deniability machine, where you could have this private company that is headed by a billionaire who really doesn't need to be making money off of this stuff, doing the ultimate off-the-books work for the CIA and in some cases for the Joint Special Operations Command. And as Professor Carmola says, one of the things that Eric Prince offered them was a one-stop shopping center to get former Navy SEALs, former Delta Force guys who already had security clearances, had already been engaged in these kinds of operations, and you take them and you put them in these sensitive roles, and it means that you're shielding the operations further from those pesky gnats in the Congress, and it also means that you can deny that they were ever there if things go wrong and that they were there for you.
Kateri Carmola, okay, we get that. We'll look more at that. But why? Is it because these wars are going on so long? Is it because they're different kinds of wars? Why do we suddenly need a plausible deniability machine?
Well, as someone once said, every age gets the pirates that it deserves. And I've got to say, Eric Prince is certainly the pirates that we deserve, and that these are not just the kinds of wars that we're fighting right now, which are complex and widespread, and they do involve a lot of special operations forces, a lot of intelligence gathering from various agencies. And so they are these complex kinds of wars, but we did downsize our military throughout the 1990s. And in downsizing the military, as well as offering retired or well-trained military men opportunities elsewhere, we created a great market for these guys to work. And then we're doing exactly what we should be doing if you're going to have a kind of nefarious idea about the whole project, is that we hire these guys when we need them, and then we're able to plausibly deny them or distance ourselves from their activities once they do exactly what we hired them to do.
Or hypothetically, just outsource. You outsource and then you can lay off. But of course, they need work, and that in itself can create a kind of mischief. I mean, once you build this force, it needs things to do. Ned in Charlottesville, Virginia. Ned, you're on the air.
Tom, thanks a lot. Yeah, I'm very concerned about this. I'm kind of a big picture guy, so just let me back up and address the whole issue of contractor mercenaries.
Okay.
My view of it is that it's a very serious problem that we have, and it's a symptom of really the failure of our of the legal institutional basis of our war powers. What's happening is these mercenaries are being used in order to avoid a draft. They are necessary because we cannot do the job with just a volunteer army. Or volunteer military, I should say. And a draft is being avoided not so much for humanitarian reasons, but because the policymakers know that if we take kids off the street and out of college from our neighborhoods and we put them into these situations to fight these kinds of, quote, wars, public support will be just like it was in Vietnam. It'll be over in a year. People won't stand for it. People basically take their military back. And so that's the big picture. It's really a serious, serious problem.
Ned, let us pick it up right there. And Kedri, let me come first to you. Do you see it that way? Is this a way of, you know, divorcing war from the political necessity of public support by exempting a lot of young men and women from service, in effect, replacing them with Blackwater? I mean, on the other hand, we've still got a lot of young American men and women at war in the service.
Big picture, I think he's actually totally right on. Stepping back just a little bit, the need for a really kind of well-trained intelligence-gathering force, not just guys with guns, well-trained how to shoot things, but actually how to gather intelligence, how to put that intelligence together. We're seeing problems with that anyway. But that kind of stuff, even in gaining security clearance, like Jeremy mentioned earlier, takes a really long time and takes a large investment on behalf of the government. And so in the short term, the need to hire right away guys who had this kind of security clearance and who had this kind of operational training already made it possible for Blackwater to step in. But long term, yes, absolutely. If we want to have these kinds of fight these kinds of wars abroad or be in these kinds of high-risk zones, if our businesses are going to be there, we're going to need something very much more like a larger standing army. And that has tremendous costs. He's pointing to some of the political sort of social costs of a large standing army. Earlier, you mentioned just the idea of covering these guys once they're out of the service, mental health, physical health, and so forth. So there's a lot of responsibility that goes along with having
a large standing army. Which we do for veterans, but not for Blackwater or private contractor veterans. Let's go to Aiken, South Carolina. Brenda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and guests.
Hi.
You asked earlier, can we do without these private forces anymore? And I would turn that question around and say, why did we ever start using them in the first place? Because whatever they do, we could train our own military and intelligence personnel to do, and do it at a fraction of the cost. We do this at obscene costs financially, politically, as far as our reputation in the world. And in the process, we've lost control. There's no accountability, and no accountability means no control. And I can see nightmare scenarios unfolding down the road.
Brenda, let us look at it. Jeremy Scahill, what about anything, you know, they can do, we can do better with national public forces, Brenda says. Do you agree?
Well, I think in general I agree, but I think it's a little more complicated than that. First of all, I just want to correct something that was said earlier. When a Blackwater or other contractor is killed or injured in the war zone, we as U.S. taxpayers actually do pay for it, because there's something called the Defense Base Act, which was passed in the 1940s. And basically, it requires contractors to get government insurance, which ultimately then is outsourced to AIG. And so when a contractor is killed, their family gets somewhere in the ballpark of $3,000 to $4,000 monthly in Defense Base Act payments. And then there are also injury benefits. And there have been thousands of contractors whose families have applied for death benefits and been approved for them, or injury benefits. But I think to cut to the bigger issue here, when you outsource very sensitive operations to these individuals and things get really murky in the world of intelligence gathering, the concern on the part of the Intelligence Committee, as expressed to me by Representative Jan Schakowsky, who chairs the subcommittee on oversight, is that you have Blackwater guys that have been rolled in on a case-by-case basis to security clearances. They don't have a permanent security clearance, and they have access to information and intelligence that even the members of the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence do not have. So they consider it to be an oversight fiasco to be using these companies. On the broader issue of could these wars be fought without them, there's no question that the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq would have been untenable without using such a huge contractor force. Right now in Afghanistan, there are 89,000 contractors working for 600 companies alongside 70,000 U.S. troops. That means that you have more contractors than soldiers in Afghanistan. And with the surge, we're going to actually have 250,000 U.S. personnel, basically a one-to-one ratio between contractors and soldiers when the Obama plan is implemented.
And, Jeremy, again, why is that? I mean, we went to war with Germany and Japan without that kind of private contractor base. We won those wars. Take us back once more. Why do
we... I think that in terms of the modern context, when Dick Cheney was the defense secretary under George H.W. Bush, he hired Halliburton, the company he would go on to head, to do a study on how to privatize as much of the military bureaucracy as possible. And the idea, beyond giving fat paychecks to corporate cronies, was to, and the company he would go on to head, was that you were going to take all of the non-combat functions of the military, the peeling potatoes, the driving trucks, the building tent cities and COMEX facilities, and you're going to have private companies do those so that you can free up all of the military as a fighting force. What that encouraged then in the 90s was an addiction and over-reliance on the private sector to the point where the military doesn't even do these things anymore. So to go back from that would mean that you would have to train a whole new generation of soldiers. You would have to reconfigure the war machine. I'm all for getting off of this addiction of contractors, but in real political terms, they are like, in the words of David Eisenberg, who is an analyst on these things, they're like the American Express card of U.S. military operations.
Let's take a call from Boston. Peter, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom, great show. First, no question, I think we need to scrutinize the Blackwater and there needs more transparency. However, that being said, the obvious reason we need these people, we do not have those type of skill sets in the military. Our military is stretched to the limit. We don't have the people to go out there. These are most of them are real highly trained and skillful people. Secondly, I think it's a bit presumptuous for our guests calling them mercenaries, and I think there's nothing wrong with honorable if they're signing up and willing to fight and take the risk of their lives. What is wrong for some of these guys who've done 8-10 years in the military now have an opportunity at Blackwater to triple their pay, get money and benefit that they're willing to sign up and risk their lives and do jobs for the American which we need? Compare that, as I'm a practicing attorney for 35 years, the first-year law schools out of Harvard's and Yale's fighting to get $175,000 to $200,000 jobs, mm-hmm. financial. Why is that less honorable than these guys who are saying, hey, I'll sign up for Blackwater and do a service for the country?
But Peter, let me ask you, I mean, you look back in history, American history, all the way back to the Revolution, you know, German soldiers for hire, the Hessians. I mean, there's a graveyard in New Jersey, an Ashbrook graveyard of all things, I think has 40 or 50 of those in it. We really looked down on soldiers for hire back in the day.
I know, but Tom, the only thing it's obvious we don't have the people. I mean, since 2003, the Marine Corps, which is my alumni, has been extended to their eyeballs, so is the Army. I mean, these kids are coming back in. It is obvious there isn't enough people of active duty types to come in and do this. Secondly, most of these, I would suggest, are high-skilled. These are veterans who have gone through 8, 10, 12, 15 years and have that special training. What is wrong if they now want to get out because obviously for whatever reason they have an opportunity to go to Blackwater, make 4 to 5 times what they were getting paid, and these CIA types who are leaving and now joining and going back to get the money, but they're also doing a good job.
Peter, let us pick it up in the minute before the break. Kateri Carmola, what do you say to Peter's observation?
I think I understand his observation. Many people make it. And I think the problem, and he should know from the Marines, is the problem is one of command and control. And if these guys are going to be operating alongside the U.S. military that is overstretched, as he says, there needs to be some very effective command and control over them. And there's sort of two time-honored ways of doing that. One is to bring them underneath the military and put them under military law in a very strict way. And that means you have to maneuver people who are doing this for profit, like Eric Prince, out of the picture, or to sort of professionalize this whole thing. David Eisenberg, again, said we need a contractor command. We need some kind of special Pentagon office that professionalizes this whole world of security contracting, especially, follows these guys, licenses them individually like the American Bar Association does. You have to pass exams. You have to get relicensed. You have to have some supervision of how you're operating. And the problem is in the places that these guys are working and under some kind of CIA or secret black ways in which they're going about things, it's very hard to have any idea what they are doing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Blackwater and private armed contracting, still in the headlines, still very much in the game. Jeremy Scahill is with us from The Nation, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army from Middlebury College. We're joined by Kateri Carmola, professor of political science there, author of the forthcoming book, Private Security Contractors and New Wars. Of course, that big shooting in the square in Baghdad raised all kinds of ire. Case dismissed back in the U.S. Blackwater said to have now reached payoffs with the families of Iraqis killed and wounded then, though they're still not happy about it. Neither is Iraq. A couple of years ago, Blackwater CEO Eric Prince, again talking with Charlie Rose, was asked if his employees acted properly in that now infamous shooting spree. 17 Iraqis left dead, charges dismissed by a U.S. federal judge. Here's his answer then.
I'm not saying it's impossible they made a mistake. I'm saying on the front end, we do a very thorough job of finding the best of the best. These are true, proven professionals that come out of the U.S. military that have significant positions of responsibility already. We put them through extensive vetting, psychological evaluations. We put them through more vetting and procedures dictated by the State Department than most soldiers in the U.S. military do. So, yes, it is a very tough job. It requires the tightest of judgment.
Blackwater CEO Eric Prince there on the vetting of his employees. Of course, they're out there with guns and a pretty broad writ. Jeremy and Kidder, we have so many questions pouring in here. Here's some from Facebook. Paul says, as a private contractor, are the services of Blackwater/Z available to other countries, or are they exclusively bound to the U.S.? What happens if the U.S. ends its contract with Blackwater? I doubt they could even afford to, he writes, considering the amount of information the U.S. government probably shares with them. Jeremy, what about that? Can anybody hire these guys? Can the U.S. afford not to contract with them, given how sewn in they've been?
Well, you know, technically, the United States has laws that fall under the purview of the State Department and the Treasury Department, where Blackwater, as a U.S. company, would have to file for a license to outsource its goods, services, or personnel to another country. Blackwater currently trains Jordanian special forces. They have an operating facility in Kenya. They are elsewhere on the African continent. They train Mexican law enforcement. They're training the Canadian special forces, including in Afghanistan. Blackwater does a pretty robust business with other nations, particularly in the realm of training. And I think, though, that what is more what is of greater concern than a foreign country hiring Blackwater is the basic accountability-free zone of other corporations hiring Blackwater to perform armed services abroad, because there you're talking about classic old-school mercenary business. And Blackwater set up an offshore company called Greystone that is registered in Barbados for the explicit purpose of renting soldiers out to any corporation or government that basically wants to rent them. So that's of great concern, I think, for people, regardless of your political perspective in this country. The idea that we're taking some of the prized possessions of the nation, that is the trained forces, and making them available on the open market for bidding.
We've seen Eric Prince talking about setting up a kind of super ship off the coast of Africa as a base for...
It's for sale.
And you can have troops come in and do anything anywhere.
Tom, if you have a couple million dollars, you can actually buy that ship. Blackwater's business clearly didn't go anywhere.
Oh,
they were trying to market it as an anti-piracy ship, and a couple of weeks ago, it actually went up for sale. So if NPR wants to purchase it, Tom, you could figure that out.
$3.9 million.
Oh, on eBay. Okay, great.
Down from about $13
million. Terrific. Yeah. Then you wonder who's going to buy that. Kateri, here's one from Judy. Says the critical issue isn't that we rely so much on private contractors, but that they operate with impunity, as you said, Kateri. She says, if we're to use special ops like Blackwater, they need to be subject to the same laws as the U.S. military and civilian personnel. And then specifically, Judy says, as to Blackwater, I am deeply disturbed, she writes, that self-described Christian crusader, and I guess he has described himself that way, is making billions off a war against Muslims. This demands an investigation. What do you say, Kateri?
She's voicing a common complaint, which is that they operate with impunity. And I think responding back to them, the contractor community says, sort of like the clip you played from Eric Prince, that no, we're highly regulated. We operate under all sorts of laws. There's a huge matrix of regulations that we try and abide by. We're some of the most well-regulated people out there. So they have this sense that they're kind of being victimized by this misperception that they operate with impunity. The reality is the laws are so complex complex and so untried and so difficult to implement that they do effectively operate with impunity. And so they're kind of – it's both sides are right in this debate. And effectively, there has been no tried and true legal personality that has developed around these guys, where there has been cases that have gone through successfully and repetitively to show that there is some way in which they can be kind of called to task for their the crimes that are out there.
And Jeremy,
I also just want to just back up Jeremy for 1 second. Mm-hmm. He's right to bring in the larger picture, which isn't just the U.S. military's use of this, but also private companies out there. I just want to transnational private companies out there using them as well.
Well, buy it and do it, and then we're left to wonder who they're working for at any given moment. But Jeremy, what about Judy's question? Where does this Christian Crusader tag on Eric Prince come from? Is that his own? And, you know, the U.S. government has been at such pains to distance itself from that kind of characterization. What if the CEO we're hiring doesn't?
Oh, well, I mean, Eric Prince is some of his closest associates are very well-known sort of Christian warrior types. Chuck Colson is very close to Eric Prince. He, of course, was Nixon's hatchet man during Watergate and then reformed himself as a very far-right evangelical minister. James Dobson, Focus on the Family, Gary Bauer, the Family Research Council. Eric Prince was around all of these guys growing up, really looked up to them. And his former employees, Eric Prince, has actually submitted sworn affidavits in one of the cases against him, saying that Prince not only views himself as a Christian crusader, but has set a tone at Blackwater that rewards the destruction of Iraqi life. And they also say that he is intent on waging a war against Muslims and destroying Islam globally. So I think there really is a cause for concern. What is the message the U.S. sends by continuing to do business in a Muslim country with this kind of a force headed by that kind of a man? One other point to the broader question that was brought up earlier about accountability. If you look at what happened at Nisr Square, these men, and I've talked to many military lawyers about this. These men would have been straight up court-martialed on murder charges. They disobeyed orders. They were not supposed to be in the square. They were supposed to have remained at a static location. The military, Lieutenant Colonel Mike Tarsa, when he investigated it on the scene, his men labeled it a criminal event, said it was unprovoked. There was no evidence of an ambush. I've talked to military lawyers very recently who said those guys should have been court-martialed, and instead they're walking on the Ali North defense, which is that their immunized statements were used against them. This is a real scandal. Blackwater has – their forces have killed many civilians in Iraq, including a bodyguard to the Iraqi vice president in the Green Zone, and no one has effectively been held to task for those actions.
Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee, and John. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Gus.
Hi.
So first question was to Jeffrey. He mentioned earlier that parts of the special operations do not operate under posse comitatus, and I was hoping he could expand upon that.
Yes, Jeremy.
Sure. Well, there was a presidential directive that was issued that allowed the U.S. military forces under the Joint Special Operations Command to operate domestically within the United States. And the logic behind it is that the CIA is prohibited from engaging in domestic operations except to target espionage agents. And the idea was that you had to have this elite counterterrorism force that could hunt down terrorists inside of the United States. And so JSOC was exempted from posse comitatus so that what is the force that's considered to be the premier counterterrorism force of the entire United States government and military would have no hindrance to pursuing suspects or suspected terrorists around the world. That's the official rationale or justification for it.
And that has practical application right now abroad, at least. I mean, you've been reporting about this sort of new intelligence frontier that Blackwater Z is on in Pakistan. Give us a sense of that, Jeremy.
Well, I mean, this goes back to at least 2006. The Musharraf government cut a deal with the Bush-Cheney administration that would allow U.S. special forces to pursue al-Qaeda suspects across the border from Afghanistan. And the idea was that the Pakistani government would permit it but would then publicly denounce it and say that it was an unauthorized move. Blackwater guys, my understanding is, first went in as part of an operation called Vibrant Fury, where they were working for the Joint Special Special Operations Command. They went into Pakistan to take out a suspected al-Qaeda safe house. A relationship was hatched then with former Special Forces guys from Blackwater that put them not only at the center of those kinds of operations, but also at a parallel drone bombing program that the military is conducting inside of Pakistan. So Blackwater is playing both sides of the U.S. National security coin in the sense of working for the CIA and JSOC. And I should say, though, that the military up and down has denied that it has anything to do with Blackwater in Pakistan. But I have former Blackwater guys that have worked on that program, as well as a very well-placed U.S. military intelligence source that say that the people that deny it are not in the circle of love, that it's so compartmentalized that they wouldn't have any business knowing about it anyway.
They wouldn't know. Wow. Kateri Carmola, you said that, you know, you started out very skeptical about Blackwater. You then kind of warmed up and said, well, maybe we need this kind of operation. Where do you stand today, big picture, on these private contractors armed in military and now intelligence activity? You've got your book coming out. What's your bottom line?
I'm not sure that's an accurate portrayal. I think what I meant was that when I first started out, mm-hmm. I thought that the whole thing was much more nefarious and well planned out. A little, and I think some of what Jeremy says kind of lends itself to that picture, that there was an explicit attempt to outsource a lot of what I at the time just said outsourcing war crimes, and that as the military became much more legally conscious and much more hidebound in a certain way, even as it was downsized, there was this need to outsource and do some things not just under the radar with the CIA, but mm-hmm. even one more step removed. Through my research, just as a scholar, I tried to sort of see the complex issues in behind that, sort of the cultural issues, the military issues, the types of combat that we're seeing, the changes within the military structure, and the changes especially within the sort of professional lifespan of so many people that the military trains, and the kind of new idea of what it means to be an all-volunteer force, an all-volunteer professional army, and what you do with the training that you have afterwards. Sort of like that one caller, the lawyer from a while ago, mm-hmm. said, you know, you have the right to use your skills.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw that more my bottom line in the end, though, is that the state needs to have absolute control over any armed actor that it has under its working alongside it. And that if you're going to actually carry weapons abroad, you need to be an explicit member of an explicit department. You can't really be a couple steps removed from any very good explicit command and control. And so these guys, I would think, would need to be, you know, my wish would be they would be brought back under a very strict bureaucratic umbrella, even if it is the CIA, and be rehired in that kind of way. Or that as that other caller, I think maybe it was Brenda, said earlier, that we would begin to really grow our own forces to do the kinds of things we need to do. There has been, I think, under Obama, a trend, at least verbally acknowledge a trend back towards insourcing, as they put it. He wants to be more of an insourcer as a president. We're not seeing much of that happen. It's going to take a very, very long time for these large organizations to adapt. And in the meanwhile, we're going to see a lot of these armed contractors playing a role. But I would ban all armed contractors outright.
Let's go to New York. Saratoga Springs, New York, and Kat. Kat, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just want to point out very quickly that it appears to me that this gentleman, Eric Prince, is a modern-day Kurtz, Joseph Conrad Kurtz. He's out in broad daylight. He's already, by definition, gone rogue. If, as the person pointed out earlier through the Vanity Fair article, which I have not read yet, but I will, if he is essentially, in so many words, graymailing his employers, the CIA, he is effectively holding the government of this country and the people of this country hostage. The man, I think if we're going to centralize our intelligence, we must centralize any military presence that we have. Otherwise, by definition, that is a rogue. And Kurtz is among us, and he's right out there. Hopefully, articles such as this Vanity Fair will actually really reveal them for what they are.
Kat, we've got it, and you put your finger there on the sort of heart of darkness, but right out in daylight. Kateri, you've met him, Eric Prince. What's he like?
Well, I got to say, if you're a true CIA asset, you don't usually – she's right to point out the fact you don't usually go to Vanity Fair and even, you know, begin to graymail. If you're really part of an organization, you stay silent for, you know, practically your entire life, I think. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine some member of Mossad, for instance, the Israeli CIA equivalent, going onto a magazine and, you know, sort of spilling their own beans or doing any kind of graymailing mm-hmm. action. He's very similar to the British version of him is Lieutenant Colonel Tim Spicer, and who also went to Vanity Fair and has also sort of been hard to get away from for the British public. He was head of a number of companies and now is head of Aegis.
But does he feel beleaguered these days, do you think? I mean, there's grand juries.
Oh, that's his whole personality, yeah. I think Eric Prince specifically feels very much a victim. And that's the picture he wanted to paint of himself in the Vanity Fair article. But it's one that he's painted in the congressional testimony that he gave and on Charlie Rose, that he's a very immoral person who's trying to do good in the world, that he's hampered by all sorts of politicians and congressional regulations and the media, that he's just trying to do the right thing and he's being hampered from all directions.
Jeremy, we've just got a minute here. If we wanted to put this genie back in the bottle, I mean, could we afford to? And is that happening now or still headed the other way?
Well, if you want to engage in these very large-scale military operations like Afghanistan and Iraq, it would take probably decades to reverse the trend. But I agree with Kettery with what she's saying about this. I think that Jan Schakowsky, her legislation that she's going to be introducing soon called the Stop Outsourcing Security Act, would prohibit any of these contractors from engaging in what are defined as inherently governmental functions. I think that the starting point is to stop using these outsourced armed individuals for these kinds of operations and stop giving them paychecks that are the equivalent of the commanding generals of these wars, because they're killing the morale of the special forces community and they're encouraging these guys to leave the military and jump to the private sector because they can make a lot more money doing that. I think that's going to be what could really nip this in the bud, is if military people start rising up against it because of the class system and the unaccountability.
Well, we have learned a lot today and we're very grateful to both of you. Kateri Carmola at Middlebury College. We'll look forward to your book coming out. It's Private Security Contractors and New Wars, Risk, Law, and Ethics. Can't wait to read it. Professor Carmola, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks, Jeremy.
And Jeremy Scahill in New York, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. It's always good to have you here. Thank you very much for joining us today, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.